So we're on Yud Ches Amud Beis, and we were speaking about the possibility of obligating the Kohen Gadol to testify in front of a Beis Din. This, despite the interrogation, is somewhat degrading, or it's a bit of a gnai or a disgrace to the Kohen Gadol when he has to show up in front of a Beis Din. And we have a precedent for this in the case of Hashavas Aveda, where the Gemara derives from the Pasuk V'salamta three different categories of pturim, of exemptions from the mitzvah Hashavas Aveda, one of which, the most important for our purposes, is what's called a Zaken V'eino L'fichvodo, that for someone to disgrace himself by returning this aveda, he has to pick up this animal and carry it, and so forth and so on, in the public place. That undermines what's called kavod abrios. And in such a case, we're going to exempt him from the mitzvah of hashavas aveda. So we have this category called zaken v'eino l'fi chvodo. We pointed out that the Rambam says that in the case of Zokei Ve'eno L'fi Chvodo, he can voluntarily return the Aveda and overlook his Kavod for the sake of this mitzvah. That he could do. But as far as obligation is concerned, he's outside of the obligation, because the Pasuk says V'salamto, which tells me that he is Mis'alim and he ignores the Aveda for the sake of protecting his honor, his kavod abrios. How can the Mishnah therefore obligate the Kohen Gadol to testify? That is no different than Zaken Ve'eino L'fi Chvodo. The Gemara is equating Hashavas Aveda with Edus, and to the same extent that in the case of an animal that has to be carried, etc., there's a pagam in his kavod abrios if he's a zaken for to be metapol with this aveda. So too there would be a pagam in the Kohen Gadol's kavod if he has to go in front of a Beis Din and testify. And therefore, how could it be that our Mishnah obligates the Kohen Gadol to testify? And Rav Yosef says that the case is that he's going to testify on behalf of the king, meaning the king himself is on trial. The Gemara completely rejects this outright, because the Mishnah says that lo donen moso, that we will not put the king on trial. So in what scenario would Rav Yosef be correct in saying that the Kohen Gadol is obligated to testify in a case in which the Melech is on trial? The Melech can't be on trial by definition. So Rav Zera tries to backpedal a little bit and say, you know what Rav Yosef had in mind? Not where the king himself is on trial, but the king's son, we'll call him the prince, the Ben Melech, is on trial. And here, according to this interpretation, it's not below the dignity of the Kohen Gadol to testify in a case where the Ben Melech is on trial, because he's doing it for the honor of the Melech. And that's a very... that's a very upgraded kind of testimony. It's a very significant case, and it would not be below his dignity to testify on behalf of the Ben Melech. The Gemara rejected this, if you recall, because Ben Melech is a hedjot, and once again, even though there is some element of Malchus here, because he is the Ben Melech, maybe he's next in line, I don't know, but nevertheless, right now he's not the Melech. And it would still be, the Gemara insists, below the covet of the Kohen Gadol to come and testify, even if the Ben Melech is on trial. So at this point, the Gemara reinterprets the case of Ben Melech and says that it's Bifnei HaMelech. So in other words, we have two factors over here. Number one, who's on trial? The Ben HaMelech is on trial. That per se would not mitigate the lowering of the dignity of the Kohen Gadol when he testifies, because the Ben Melech at the end of the day is still a hedjot, he's not a Melech. However, who's going to be, shall we say, motivated to participate in this judgment of the Ben Melech? it's going to be the Melech himself. Now, the Gemara vacillates back and forth. What do you mean the Melech himself? The Melech is going to sit on the court as a judge? And there's going to be testimony against his own son? That's highly unlikely. So the Gemara says, Bifnei Melech means that the Melech will be present at the court case. He is not going to in any way actively participate in the court case. So he's not part of the Sanhedrin. And the Gemara invokes a brisa that says, Ein Moshivin Melech b'Sanhedrin. But the Gemara says that what's going to happen is that the Melech is very interested in having the Kohen Gadol testify. So what is he going to do? He's going to show up at the court case. And at that point, the judges are going to accept the testimony of the Kohen Gadol. And it's not beneath the dignity of the Kohen Gadol to testify in this case, because who's present in the courtroom? None other than the Melech himself. And I'm going to just read the Gemara's language. This is all just to review what we did yesterday on Daf Yud Ches Amid Beis. The Gemara says, Mishum Yukara the Kohen Gadol, in order so that not to disgrace the Kohen Gadol, but at the same time to allow the Kohen Gadol to testify without lowering his dignity. Asa, he comes, meaning the king comes with Yosef and he sits there. Mekable Nialola Sadusa, and he sits in the courtroom. But he's not part of the judges. He's not one of the judges on the Sanhedrin. And that is going to upgrade the level of this entire ambiance here of the courtroom, such that it's now no longer below the dignity of the Kohen Gadol to testify. Kaihu, after the testimony is given, he stands up, meaning the king stands up, V'azil, and he checks out. He leaves. We will check out the law. In other words, we will now investigate weigh the evidence. I think that would be a better word. We're going to weigh the evidence back and forth, the pros and cons, and that's called daininon. We're going to judge. And who's on trial now? The Ben Melech. And we're going to hand down a verdict based on the testimony of the Kohen Gadol. How is the Kohen Gadol able to testify? That's because at the moment of his testimony, who was present? The Melech was present. Again, after the testimony is given, the Melech is out of here. You know, that's... But what he accomplishes is that this Eidus is no longer below the dignity of the Kohen Gadol, because the king was there sitting together with the Sanhedrin. They accepted the Eidus of the Kohen Gadol, and then the king is out, the Kohen Gadol could go back to his role in the Beis HaMikdash, and we're going to judge the Ben Melech. So again, Rabbi Hossa, it's really odd. You know, you open up the first Mishnah in the second Perek of Sanhedrin, and it says, Kohen Gadol, Meid, etc. And that word Meid is a very, very specific case. Who's on trial? The Ben Melech. Why is it not below the dignity of the Kohen Gadol to show up? Because the king is there at the time of the Kabbalah's Eidus. I mean, all this has to be put into that one word of the Mishnah, Meid. So I just want to share with you a very famous question of the Tumim. His name was Rabbi Yonasan Ivashitz, about 250 years ago. And he says, I don't understand why the Gemara has so much problems here with Meid. Maybe the word Meid is telling me that he's allowed to testify. You remember we said in the name of the Rambam, that although it's below the dignity of the Kohen Gadol to testify under normal conditions, and therefore he fits into the category of Zokin Veinu L'Fichvodo, that's only a ptur. That only exempts him from the obligation to testify. But it doesn't mean that he cannot testify. We're not blocking him. If he is motivated out of the goodness of his heart to show up in Beis Din and tolerate all the interrogation against him, then Tovala Bracha, let him be blessed for such a thing, because he's going Vasisa Vayosha Tov with Nimishur Sadin. So maybe the word Meid here means that we're going to allow him to testify. And then if you look at the Sefer of the Mishnah, in the case of the Melech says Lo Meid. What it means is that Melech is not given that option of being Mavater, of waving his kavod and fulfilling the mitzvah of Asisa V'yashra Tov, because that would undermine the position of Malchus. Do you follow? we have a principle, I don't know if you're familiar with it, this Gemara in Kiddushin, that Melech Shemachal Kvodo Ein Kvodo Machal, meaning the Kvod of the Melech is not just his own personal honor, but he represents the Malchus, the entity of Malchus. And on that he can't be Mochel. So the difference between Meid and Ein Meidim, says the Tumah, meaning the Kohen Gadol situation, and that of the Melech, is that whereas the Kohen Gadol is given the option of testifying, and again, that's purely optional and voluntary on his part, a Melech doesn't even have the option of testifying. He's completely excluded from the mitzvah of testimony because of his status as a Melech. It's a brilliant kasha of the Tumim. I mean, the best answer you could give is that there's a linguistic issue here, that when it says Meid, it sounds like it means he's obligated to testify. And the Gemara is doing somersaults in the air to come up with a Heichat Timtza situation, a scenario in which he's obligated to testify. Yeah.
Even without testifying, with the Melech, isn't his presence in the
I don't know. I mean, I can only derive the mathematical conclusion here that's not so. And I'll tell you what it is. The evidence is really post Eidus. What I mean to say is that once the Eidus is accepted, and the Eidim, how should I say, they comply with all the requirements of the Eidus, they answer all the right questions, and they fulfill all the requirements, that's when the Diyun begins. In other words, the judgment and the weighing of the evidence, maybe you're right, but again, I would actually turn your question, Jeremy, into an answer to my question. Why does the Gemara emphasize that after the Kabbalah's Eidus, it says, Kai Hu V'Azil? You know, is that just giving him a green light? He doesn't have to stay for the balance of the judgment. Let's throw out a possibility that maybe we want to get rid of the Melech because now we're weighing the evidence. But as far as the Kabbalah's Eidus is concerned, that's objective. You know, we have a list of questions that we have to ask the Eidim. We have to check out to make sure the Eidim are Ksherim, they're not related to each other, etc., etc. And once they pass all those tests, then the Eidus itself is like an objective entity. You know, we have a description of
is that public, Bichlal?
I don't know whether it's public or not, but certainly in front of the Sanhedrin it's public. So what I'm saying is that what the Sanhedrin now have in front of them is almost like an affidavit which contains the testimony. Like, for example, in secular law, you could actually sign an affidavit, and if it's notarized, you could send it into a court. I'm not saying in all cases, but I'm just saying there is such a thing. In halacha, there's no such thing. You have to show up in front of a bezdin. But once you do that, and you comply with all the requirements of the bezdin, now we're ready for stage two, and that's going to be the diyun. You know, we're going to weigh that evidence against other evidence, and all the factors of the case have to be taken into consideration.
But when Eidus is being given, there's other people other than the Sanhedrin that are there, and the Eidim? Adam and Sanhedrin, there's anybody else there?
As far as I know, the Talmidim of the Sanhedrin are there. We invite them in, and they sit in a separate place, shuros, so that they can learn about the judgment. There's a whole issue whether the Talmidim have a right to open their mouths and express an opinion, or argue with one of the members of Sanhedrin with a question. Now, Rabosai, let's go back to the Mishnah for one moment. And I want to focus your attention on the Ishus part of this Mishnah, the laws of marriage. We had a great discussion yesterday about the Avelus element in this Mishnah and how Avelus impacts on the Kohen Gadol, how the Kohen Gadol changes the laws of Avelus in two directions, both in terms of how he experiences his Avelus and number two, how others are menachim him when he's in Avel. But there's another part of this Mishnah, and that is the Ishus part of the Mishnah. So what happens now? We have a concept called Yibum V'Chalitza. Okay? Maybe we could close the door if it's not too much of a hassle. In Yibum and Chalitza, obviously what happens is that the Kohen Gadol dies and he leaves a wife who... And he has no children, and now she needs Yibum or Chalitza. So here's where the Mishnah emphasizes that in the case of a Kohen Gadol, her, in other words, his wife, she falls to Yibum and Chalitza, and there's no prohibition with regard to the brother, the surviving brother, to marry his sister-in-law when she falls for Yibum, even though she was once married to the Kohen Gadol. In contrast, in the Sefer, the case of the Melech, there the Mishnah says, Lo choletz v'lo choltzim li'ishto. And the reason for that is that no one's allowed to marry the wife, the widow, shall we say, of the Melech. They're allowed, there's no prohibition against marrying the widow of the Kohen Gadol, but in contrast, there's no marriage that's allowed for the widow of the Melech. Again, we saw in our Mishnah that there might be an exception to that case if a Melech wants to marry the wife, the widow of a Melech. That was the case of David and Shaul's widow. But barring that exception, the widow of a Melech cannot be married. If she can't be married, she doesn't fall for Yibum. There's no possibility of Yibum. And there's no meaningful Chalitza here, because the purpose of Chalitza is to allow her to get married. But even after the Chalitza, she can't marry anyone because she's Almanoso Shel Melech. But again, none of that applies in the case of the Kohen Gadol. But now we can ask the opposite question. Flip it around. What happens? Not that the Kohen Gadol died and he left a widow, childless, let's say. But let's say in the opposite case, where his brother died. So the brother of the Kohen Gadol dies and leaves a wife childless. Again, when I say childless, I'm not going into all the nitty-gritty details. I'm just the sabertos. And she falls for Yibum to the Kohen Gadol. Now, we have two issues that we can raise over here. One issue is Chalitza. And why is Chalitza an issue? Who remembers what we discussed? I think it was a few days ago. Because the Yarkol Afanov, that she has to spit in front of him, so she's spitting in front of the Kohen Gadol. And that's a Pegia in the covet of the Kohen Gadol. Now, we said before that as far as Eidus is concerned, although the Kohen Gadol is only obligated to testify in one very narrow case, but the Rambam says that in all other cases, the Kohen Gadol optional can opt voluntarily to testify and be mochel on his cover. Let's apply the same logic to Chalitza. So it means that his sister-in-law now falls for Chalitza, and if he gives a Chalitza, it would be voluntary. But yeah, take a look at the Mishnah. The Mishnah on the third line says, Aval hu eino miyavim. Just one second. Aval hu eino miyavim mipnei shehu asur bialmona. Wow, here's a very interesting thing. When his sister-in-law falls for Yibum, she's an almona. A Kohen Hedjit is allowed to marry an almona, but a Kohen Gadol, the Torah says, Hu isha b'psula, he's not allowed to marry an almona. So once she was married, he can't marry her. So Yibum is completely out. But we said that Chalitza is optional. Choletz. Now, here's a case where we have Chalitza without a possibility of Yibum. Let me go over that one more time just to make sure my mathematics is correct over here. Again, the Kohen Gadol cannot be miyabim his sister-in-law because she's an almana. But yet Chalitza will give her, and she's allowed to marry anyone else after he gives her Chalitza. So Chalitza is to be mater her so that she can marry someone else, correct? What do you say?
I'm saying, as opposed to,
you see the difference here between a Kohen Gadol and a Melech. In the case of the Melech, if he gives a Chalitza, it's meaningless because she can't marry anyone. She's Almanoso Shel Melech. But the Almanoso here is the Almana of his late brother, and now she needs Chalitza desperately to allow to get married. He himself, the Kohen Gadol, has an additional mitzvah of Yibum, but that's impossible because she's an Almana, but nevertheless Chalitza is still a possibility. So the Chiddush here of the Mishnah is that although she'll spit in front of him, nevertheless he still he's still included in chalitza. Otherwise, she would not be able to get married to anyone. So far, so good. Oh, so he gives a chalitza, even though it's impossible for him to be miyavim her. So what this seems to indicate is that there is chalitza even without yibum. Do you follow me? It's not two sides of one coin, haba hatalia. You can have chalitza without yibum. Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't see any derabbanan here right now. I'm just saying that the Mishnah is now telling me that he's choletz, right? Choletz aval eino miyavim. It doesn't it say that, right? Choletz on the second line. You skip to the third line. Aval eino miyavim because he's also balmona. Now you may ask me, why am I making such a big deal about this? Because the Gemara says in Masechet Yevamos that yibum and chalitza are two sides of a coin. And if there's yibum, then there's chalitza. And if there's chalitza, there's yibum. But if there's no yibum, then there's no chalitza. I'll give you an example. What would be an example of a case where there's no yibum and therefore there's no chalitza? The Gemara has the following scenario. A man is married to two women and he dies. He has no children. Now his two wives fall for yibum. So the Gemara says that he's only obligated to be miyabim one of them. He doesn't have to be miyabim two of them. And then the Gemara goes on and says that since he doesn't have to be miyabim both of his late brother's wives, only one of them, he chooses one, the other one doesn't need chalitza. Why? Because once he makes the choice of which of the two wives he wants to be miyabim, then there's no mitzvah of yibum vis-a-vis the other wife. And as a result, there's no chalitza. Meaning there's no need for chalitza. So here's a case in the Kohen Gadol where she needs chalitza although there's no possibility of yibum. And now I'm perplexed because I'm trying to figure out here what is the rule. Is there, you know, you exclude chalitza, is there still a need for, I'm sorry, you exclude yibum, I meant to say, is there still a need for chalitza? Should we say A or B? Should we say A, once there's no yibum, then therefore ipso facto there's no chalitza? And that seems to be indicated by Sugya Yevamos Adaf Mem Dalet, that if there's no yibum vis-a-vis the other wife, then Mimela she doesn't need chalitza. Or do we say no? Even if there's no yibum, like in the case of the Kohen Gadol, he cannot be miyabim his almana, but nevertheless there still will be chalitza. I don't know. I'm just throwing this out. Maybe at 10,
why
at 10:30.
Why do you say there's no yibum? Why do you say there's no yibum? There's yibum not by the Kohen Gadol, but there's yibum.
What if he has another brother, you mean? Or what? Is that what you mean? If there are two brothers, you're saying that. Two surviving brothers. I don't know what you meant. Joseph, what did you mean when you said there still is yibum? There is no yibum. Let's assume for argument's sake there's only one brother. That's the Kohen Gadol. He can't be miyabim, she's an almana. So I would have said that there's no need for chalitza in that case. Why? Because the rule is that when there's yibum, the alternative that's absolutely necessary is chalitza. But if the Torah blocks yibum, then the mela don't need chalitza. And that's going to be the case of Shnei Batim, what's called in the Gemara's language, when he's married to two wives. Okay, I'm just pointing out that there's a lot of work, you know, a lot of work to be done over here.
Maybe the idea was that it was optional, not required, but optional.
Again, Jerry, if you're saying it's optional, what you're telling me is that it's meaningful and it's necessary. Meaning, out of the goodness of his heart, he's going to give a chalitza because she needs chalitza. But why does she need chalitza if she doesn't really fall for yibum? I mean, somehow we're going to have to say that she does fall for yibum, but but Lomaisa, he can't do the yibum because the Torah says yibum, that she's an alman.
If he did yibum, it would be chal, right? Mashiach came by the melech, maybe.
Well, again, when you say it would be chal, would it be a mitzvah of yibum? It would be chal because we recognize the marriage. So I would say that in the case of Shnei Batim, which means that a man dies and leaves two wives, if he was miyabim both of them, oh, I don't know, then you might say that if there's no mitzvah of yibum, then it becomes Eishes Achim. So wait, let's just think, in the Kohen Gadol case, you're saying that it's only almana to Kohen Gadol, then there would be thesis kedushin, let's say, except for Rabbi Akiva, right? Fine. But if there's no mitzvah of yibum, yes, I don't know. You know, that Joseph is asking a very interesting question. Let's say the Kohen Gadol went ahead and he was miyabim her. Would she be an Ashes Ish? So then I would say that if the Iser Almana removes the mitzvah of Yibum, then she becomes Ashes Ach, which means there's no Tfisus Kedusha. We wouldn't even recognize that marriage. Because Ashes Ach is an Erevah. The only reason we recognize that marriage is because of the mitzvah of Yibum, but here there's no mitzvah of Yibum. Again, I'm just pointing out that we haven't even barely scratched the surface here. All right, for today we want to start with Gufa. So let's see if we can find the word Gufa. We're about halfway down on Yud Ches Amud Beis. And the first word in the line is V'azil. And if this helps anybody, you see a Tosus on the right side that says V'hatnan, not V'ha Ein Moshiv, but V'hatnan. So if you go down halfway through that small Tosus, or if you want, you go up a little bit from Tosus Mishum Tzina, you'll see a line that starts V'azil, and if your eye moves across that line, you'll see the word Gufa. Now Gufa means we go back to something that we saw earlier. We quoted a Braisa earlier, just a few lines earlier in the Gemara, that says, quote, Ein Moshivin Melech B'Sanhedrin V'lo Melech V'Kohen Gadol B'Ibur Shana. We're going to have a lot to discuss here about the Seifa of the Braisa, about Ibur Shana. But first, let's start with the Reisha. A Melech cannot serve on the Sanhedrin. And presumably he has all the credentials in terms of his knowledge of Torah to serve on the Sanhedrin. But nevertheless, it's a separate din that a Melech cannot sit on the Sanhedrin. He could sit in the courtroom, but he can't sit on the Sanhedrin. So the Gemara wants to know why. And the Gemara says the following. Melech b'Sanhedrin, why is a Melech excluded from Sanhedrin? Dichsiv, the Pasuk says in Parshas Mishpatim, it says, Lo sane al riv. Now, when we come to Drashas HaTorah, then very often what we do is we change the vocalization of a word. So instead of reading it as Riv, we're going to read it as Rav. The reason we have to read it as Riv is because it says Riv with a Yud. But nevertheless, if you look at the Shorish of the word, it's Rav. Now Rav means two things. In a strict, narrow definition, the word Rav refers to a rabbi. But in the broader definition, Rav refers to anyone who is called a Gadol. He's considered absolutely great. So let's say, for example, if you have a Sanhedrin, and there's the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, he's considered the Rav of the Sanhedrin. He's the greatest of all the members of the court. He has the highest stature and status. He will only be invited to express his opinion in any case at the very end. In other words, after all the other members of the court have expressed their view, then and only then will he express his view. And he'll say, it looks from this evidence that we should conclude thusly. Why is he the last one to express his view? And the answer is because of this pasuk, Losana al Riv, which means Losana al Rav. That if he would express his view, because he has this high status of kavod, then the members of the Sanhedrin would not be allowed to disagree with him. And the Gemara is now applying that to the Melech. That the Melech is also considered a Rav, meaning he's someone who's considered a Gadol. So therefore, let's say the king would say, in the course of this deliberation in front of the Sanhedrin, well, I think this fellow is guilty as accused, then the other judges on the court will not be allowed to contradict him and say, well, we found this chus, we found him to be, there's a lot of this, you know, this evidence that would acquit him. And therefore, it's impossible to set up the melech on the Sanhedrin. Rabbi said, what question should you ask on this Gemara? There's an obvious question.
It could be Nasi.
Yeah, let him be the last one to express his view. We said already in the case of Nasi that even though the violation of Lo San al Riv, meaning Rav, would apply, so we solve that problem. We're not going to exclude the Nasi from the Sanhedrin, just that we'll wait until the end of the deliberations until he expresses his opinion. Why not apply the same mechanism in the Melech's frame of reference? And Tosus raises this question. He goes even a step further. He says that maybe the Melech could simply be Shosek, you know, let him not say a word. So here Tosus comes up with the following: that a melech is even greater than a nasi, and his covenant is so great that we're not going to allow anyone to open up their mouth, any member of the Sanhedrin, before the melech. In the case of the nasi, it's standard protocol in the Sanhedrin that the nasi will express his opinion at the end. But in the case of a melech, since the melech will have to sit there wincing, I'm just adding that for drama purposes, right? Squeezing himself while every single member of the court expresses his opinion, and basically we're telling the melech, pardon the phrase here, shut your mouth until the end of the court case, that itself is a pegiah in the covenant of the melech. So the bottom line is that we cannot work it out in such a way that the melech will sit on the court as a member of the Sanhedrin. Okay, now the Braisa goes on, and it says, Lo melech v'kohen gadol be'ibur shana. Here we're going to have an equation between the melech and the kohen gadol. Both of them are excluded from a bezdin of ibur shana. Okay, now in the case of Ibur Shana, let's go back for a moment to refresh our memory from the Mishnah at the beginning of Sanhedrin. And the Mishnah says on Daf Beis Amud Aleph that Ibur HaChodesh Bishlosha, Ibur HaShana Bishlosha, Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rav Shimon Gamliel Omer Bishlosha Maschilin B'chamisha nosim v'nosim v'gomru v'shiva, but im gomru b'gimel me'uberes. The bottom line is that we're talking about a lower court that's comprised of three judges. During the course of the deliberation, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel insists that we add members to the court, but as far as what's critical is concerned, all we need is three judges. Now, the Gemara is assuming now that in a court of three judges, we don't have a problem of Lo Sana al Riv. If you recall, the ratio of this price says, Ein Moshivin Melech B'Sanhedrin. So then we're talking about a Sanhedrin that could even judge a person and condemn him to death. There, we have a principle of Lo Sana al Riv. There's going to be a lot of deliberations, and it would be impossible to allow for those deliberations if the king is a member of the court. That's called Sanhedrin. However, when we talk about Ibur Shana, then we're no longer talking about deliberations on that level of Sanhedrin. We're just going to deliberate as to whether or not the need for adding another month to the year, right, that's Ibur Shana, we add an extra Adar, has arisen. So here, we're not going to violate Lo Sana al Riv. So the Braisa now is telling us a chiddush that despite the fact that there's no issue about Lo Sana al Riv, nevertheless we cannot appoint the melech to sit on this bezdin for Ibur Shana. So the Gemara wants to know why not. What is the problem? And the Gemara is going to tell us that herein lies the difference between the melech and the kohen gadol. Neither of them will be allowed to be part of this bezdin for Ibur Shana, but for two different reasons. In the case of the Melech, Mishum Afsanya. Afsanya is a reference to wages. The king is responsible to take from the treasury, the national treasury, money to pay wages. For example, the soldiers in the army, they need wages because they have to support themselves, and now they're giving themselves totally to the army. Now, what happens when you add an extra month of Adar? So the contract was signed and sealed, and the amount of money that's forthcoming for the wages is set. It's set in stone. And now you add an extra month. So the contract goes from, let's say, I'm just throwing at it, from Rosh Hashanah till Rosh Hashanah. So it's a full year contract. Now, if that year is made up of 13 months instead of 12 months, then the king and his treasury gain a full month. Why? Because they're going to get another month's worth of work at the same rate. So that's called afsanya. And what the Gemara means to say is that the king has vested interest here in adding an extra month. Now, does that mean that he's going to deliberately do so even if the year doesn't need an extra month? I don't know. More likely, I think what the Gemara is saying is that it may influence him on a subtle level, almost subconsciously. But he can't be totally, totally objective because he has vested interest here. He gains a full month's worth of salary. The Kohen Gadol, on the other hand, he's not in charge of divvying out the monies of the treasury, so salary and adding an extra month is not relevant to the Kohen Gadol. That's not his headache. Why then does he have vested interests in the case of Ibur Shana? So the Gemara answers, Mishum Tzina. What this means is that the most difficult day of the year for the Kohen Gadol, if you have to isolate one day, is which day?
Yom Kippur.
Now, when it comes to Yom Kippur, what's going to happen is that he's doing a massive amount of work. Not only that, his avoda includes what we call Chamesh Tfilos and Asar Kiddushim. In other words, he's got to go down into the mikvah five times. Now, we don't have, at the time of the Kohen Gadol, heated mikvahs. Today we have a heated mikvah. But if you don't have a heated mikvah, then it's very difficult to submerge yourself so many times in cold water and come out of the mikvah into cold air. And that means that the colder the climate is, then the more difficult and challenging it is for the Kohen Gadol. So the Gemara now assumes the following. That if the year becomes me'uberes, because you added an extra Adar, you're pushing Tishrei into what?
Kesher.
Into the winter. Do you follow me by the winter? In other words, by postponing Tishrei for 1 month, because you've beefed it up, beefed up the year with the second Adar, so you've pushed Tishrei forward, now it becomes cold climate. So what would normally be Tishrei, which is kind of like September, let's say, now becomes Cheshvan. Again, we're going to call it Tishrei because we were Ma'aber the Shana, but now it's really Cheshvan. So it turns out that the day of Yom Kippur now is closer to the winter, and that's not a good thing for the Kohen Gadol. That's bad news for the Kohen Gadol. So once again, we're not saying that the Kohen Gadol is going to deliberately, falsify the truth here in order to get his benefit, but it does have some sort of a subtle influence on his thought process. He's not totally objective. Let me just read to you a few words here of background. He says, Avodas Yom HaKippurim Nasei Sayidei Kohen Gadol Bilvad. No one else can do the Avoda. The Eshba Chamesh Tvilos. The Eser Pa'amim Kiddush Yadayim V'Raglayim. So even Kiddush Yadayim V'Raglayim, he exposes his body to the cold. Hanasim Bein HaAvodos. Kechamesh Pa'amim Utovel Tvila. Mekadish Yadav V'Raglav. Lifnei Tvila. Achreach Tvila. And now, what it turns out is that the mikveh is very cold. So if you take a look at Tosis, Dibra Maskel Mishum Tzina, Tosis hints at a problem here. They didn't have heated mikvahs, but the Gemara tells us in Masechta Yoma that they did have a way of heating up the mikvah. What did they do? They would take a piece of steel, or if you want to call it a kumkum, and this has to do with the sugya of Eloi Govar and Tatoi Govar. You know what I'm talking about? But anyway, I don't want to complicate matters. Let's just assume that there's no isur to take hot water and pour it into cold water and warm up the water. It'll never get absolutely hot because of the principle called Tatoi Govar, which means that basically when you pour hot into cold, it's a cooling process. But although it's a cooling process, the water still remains somewhat warm. So Tosis asks the following question: Why is the Kohen Gadol have to be so nervous about the cold water? We can heat up a kumkum of chamin and pour it into the mikvah. Lachain Nir Lafarish, based on this kashi, wants to reinterpret that mishum krirus haritzba shekol ayom ha'yomed yachif. That the Kohen Gadol has to do the avoda barefoot. That's true for all Kohanim, but in the case of the Kohen Gadol on Yom HaKippurim, that means for 24 hours he's standing barefoot on a cold floor. Now, how cold is the floor? And the answer is, the more it's in the winter, the colder the floor gets. So he would rather have Yom Kippur earlier in the seasons and closer to let's say the summer season than postpone it and project it into the winter when the floors would be cold. Okay, now Omar Rav Papa. Now from Omar Rav Papa until the bottom of the Amud is a bit of a challenging sugya. I'm going to try to offer my introduction to the sugya and you know, either I'll be successful or I won't be. Maybe I'll be partially successful. The assumption of this Gemara in interpreting the Braisa was that if you add an extra month to the calendar, then what you're going to do is you're going to be projecting and postponing a month into a colder season, meaning that now that month is in the winter, so to speak, as opposed to being in the summer. Now that's a very problematic assumption, and it touches on the whole essence of Yibur Shani. You may remember that earlier in Sanhedrin we had a discussion about Yibur Shana. And there were many reasons for Yibur Shana. It wasn't just Kufos, what we call, meaning the seasons of the year. There were other reasons that have to do with the Peros HaIlan, that have to do with the vegetation that's growing in the fields. So that it's not absolutely clear that by adding an extra month of Adar, what you've done is you have now pushed off that month of, let's say, Tishrei or any month into the next season. So in this case of Tishrei into the winter, that's not really clear because there may be other factors and other reasons why Beis Din was motivated to be Ma'abra the Shon. But Rabosa, it gets even more complicated than that, because even if you're talking about Tkufos, what happens is that the lunar calendar and the solar calendar, there's a discrepancy. Let's say on an average year there's a discrepancy of, I'm just going to round it off to 10 days, and the lunar calendar is falling behind the solar calendar. And what happens is that after an accumulation of Lamazug in 3 years, there's a full month's worth of discrepancy. So basically what the purpose of Yibur Hashana is to realign the Chodesh Hashana with its natural tkufos. So the whole premise here of this Gemara is very difficult. Why do you assume, why would the Kohen Gadol be afraid that by adding another month he's changing the seasons? No. What he's doing is he's correcting or realigning or equalizing, I don't know which word you want to use here, the solar calendar, the lunar calendar with the solar calendar. So it's not that what's going to happen is that what was meant to be a warm Yom Kippur now turns out to be a cold Yom Kippur. No, what we're really going to do is Yom Kippur is going to fall in its time. If you don't add a month to the year, Yom Kippur is going to fall in a different tkufa, not in its natural tkufa. So what we're really, our goal then in the case of Ibra Shana is to make sure and guarantee that Yom Kippur will, I'm just giving that one example, Yom Kippur will fall in its proper time. Why? Because we're going to catch up on the lag between the lunar calendar and the solar calendar. Did anybody understand the word that I said? Mm-hmm. Let's see it inside. I mean, that was just an attempt at giving some introduction, a perspective of where the Gemara is going. Omar Av Papa, Shmami Na, from the fact that the Kohen Gadol is not allowed to participate in Ibur Shana on that Bezdin, because he has vested interests against Ibur Shana, it means Shata Bosar Yarcha Azil. Shata means the year and its seasons, meaning the time for cold and hot. Basar Yarcha Azil, they go according to the months. So let me read to you a summary here of Rashi. Again, Tosfos has a problem with Rashi, but I want to read a summary of Rashi. You can follow this inside in the Rashi Divrei Maskil Kohen Gadol, which is about, I would say, halfway down the Amud. But here's the summary as it's presented in my Gemara. Basar Yarcha Azil Holchim Lefi Achadashim Shai Reuim Lios Lilo Ibure Shanim Shalachen Kasher Ma'abrim Es Hashana Bo Sofas Chodesh Nidchim Kol Achadashim B'Chodesh Echad. All the months are postponed. And therefore, Makdim Hakar Lavo Chodesh Konim Lachem, Vitzinas the cold of Cheshvan, now as a result of Ibur Shana, Nofeles B'Tishrei. The underlying premise of this Brisa and the vested interest of the Kohen Gadol in Ibur Shana is that by adding another month, what you're doing in effect is you're taking the coldness of Cheshvan, and now it's going to be in Tishrei, that very weather condition that would have been appropriate, if not for the Ibur Shana, for the month of Cheshvan, which again is already a cold month, right? We already had some cold weather here in this month. Is that cold is now going to fall out in Cheshvan? Shim lo kein. Ela, if you'd say the opposite, says Rav Papa, Shegam achrei ha'ibur lo bat sinas cheshvin b'tishrei, Ela hino felis b'cheshvin, if you're going to say the coldness of cheshvin remains in cheshvin, and all you did by adding a month is guaranteeing that the coldness of cheshvin will be in cheshvin, and you can only do so by adding the month, is ma'ich paslo l'kohen gadol b'ibur hashana, what vested interest does he have? Kevan she'ein tishrei karyoser, by adding an extra month of Adar, you don't make Tishrei colder because the coldness of Cheshvan is going to remain in Cheshvan. So, Bekitzar Maisa, if we summarize this whole discussion, the Gemara is now vacillating, and Rav Papa sees in our Raisa one particular road, and the Gemara is vacillating on the following point. What happens when you add a month of Adar? And there are two possibilities. One possibility is to say that now you mocked him the car of Cheshvan to Tishrei. So what would have been the coldness of Cheshvan now becomes the coldness of Tishrei. The other possibility is to say no, the coldness of Cheshvan remains the coldness of Cheshvan. What we're doing by adding an extra month is we're guaranteeing that that will be the case. And the weather conditions of Tishrei remain identical for the month of Tishrei, despite the Ibur Hashana. And Rav Papa points out that from the premise that underlies the Kohen Gadol's inability to sit on the Bezdin of Ibur Hashana, it means that the premise of the Gemara is that what you're doing is you're being Magdim through Ibur Hashana, the coldness of Cheshvan into Tishrei. So the Gemara asks, Eini, I'm going to prove that this is not so. Meaning that even when they add an extra month, as far as the car and home situation, whatever was meant to be in that month of Cheshvan will remain in that month of Cheshvan. And ipso facto, Tishrei will remain the same weather conditions as before. And how am I going to prove that? I'm going to prove it from a certain story that took place in front of the Amoraim. What happened? The Maisa was that Hanach Shlosha Roi Bakar, there were three cattle herdsmen, Dahavi Kaime, they were standing and they were having a discussion in the month of Adar. Visham Inu Rabbanan de Kamri, and the rabbis overheard their conversation. And based on what they overheard in that conversation, they made the decision as to whether or not this month should be Adar, this coming month, or it should be Shvat, because we're going to add another month. So the decision of Iv Rosh Hashanah is going to be made on the eavesdropping of hearing what these Roei Bakar are going to say to each other about the agricultural and climactic conditions that were extant then. Chad Omar, and basically what we're going to see is that in each one of these statements, they're basically saying the same thing in other words, meaning that the different ways of coming to the same conclusion. Chad Omar, Im Bakir Velakish, Kechada Yonetz, Dain Hu Adar, Vim Lav, Les Dain Adar. I'm just going to read through the Gemara quickly first. Vechad Omar, Im Tar Bitzfar Bislag Yomus, Ubitira Bitul Te'ena, Yidmoch Yishlach Mashke, Dain Hu Adar, Vim Lav, Les Dain Adar. So again, the Roei Bakar trying to give us simonim as to whether or not we should be adding a month, and the question is whether we're in Shvat or whether in Adar. V'chad, we're up to the third one. Omar, he declared, Im kidum takif l'chadu yehe, is yipach b'loach nafik l'kivle. Is then dinu, denu, this month is Adar, v'im lav, less den Adar, but rather this month is Shvat. Now all this has to do with the heat of the weather conditions. And each one of the Roei Bakar is going to use a different simon to determine what the heat is. When the Chachamim overhear each one of the Roei Bakar, Ibru Rabbona Lahishata, based on the statements of these Roei Bakar, they made a decision that Adar became Shvat, and they added another month. They added a month of Adar. And the bottom line is that what this is going to prove is that the Iv Rosh Hashanah, once it's implemented and you add an extra Adar, that month is not going to be a summer month. It's not going to be hot like Nisan. But rather, it's going to remain in its regular weather conditions, and that Adar will be exactly like any other Adar. And basically, the adding of a month is only to guarantee that the conditions that were supposed to be in Adar, those weather conditions, will actually be in Adar. And therefore, Tishrei, which is months down the line, is not going to be a different Tishrei from any other year, because just like the Adar, now by adding another month, is going to remain Adar, so you'll have a second month of Shvat, which we call the first of the two Adars, and that's going to guarantee that the climactic conditions of Adar will be the same as they always are. And it means that the Iv Rosh Hashanah is just to rectify that discrepancy between this year and what would be a normal year, meaning between the solar and the lunar calendar. So the Gemara says you're making a big mistake. Again, Rav Osser, we're going to have to come back to the Aramaic. Maybe that we'll do tomorrow, just to go through the various statements of the Roi Baka. But I just wanted to get the framework of the sugya. V'tizbara, he says, are you really correct that the Chachamim accepted the analysis of these Roi Baka? Rabbanan ara avasa samuch? Do you think that the rabbis, the rhetorical question, relied upon the herdsmen, the Roi Bakar? That's not possible. Ella Rabbanan achush benayu samuch. The ultimate decision that this year needs an Ibur and they added an extra month, so instead of Adar it became Shvat, is Roi Bakar istiyue hu distaya milsa. All they did by, all the Rabbanan accomplished by eavesdropping and to hear what the Roi Baka had to say is only to give them a little bit of extra siyata. Siyata means support. So in other words, it was, so to speak, lucky. You know, this is all part of providence, but it was lucky for them that they heard the statements of the Roi Baka that this should be the month of Shvat, meaning that we're not yet in Adar. The climactic conditions are not appropriate for Adar. So when the Chachamim overheard that, that gave them further strength, or how should I say, conviction, and removed their inhibition to add another month. Why? Because the Roi Baka already told them that this month doesn't look like Shvat. Right, because of the discrepancy over the course of a few years, what's going to happen is if this is Adar, then why aren't we seeing the warmth, the Karka and so forth, the Choma Karka? Well, we're going to see about the Shvarim, the various activities, the behaviors of the oxen. This is not typical of the month of Adar. Therefore, we need an extra month to push off Adar, so that Adar would reflect the normal conditions of the climate of Adar. And therefore, the Rabbanan had extra push, so to speak, to support their decision to be Ma'abra the Shana. But essentially, the Rabbanan made their decision independent of the Roi Baka. So it could be that in this particular case of that Ibur Shana, it might have been coincidental that Adar remained Adar and Tishrei remained Tishrei, but that's not built into the system. And therefore, our Papa says, Shema Mino Shata Baso Yarcha Azil. In other words, in that particular case, you see that the Chadashim are going to be impacted by the Ibur Shana to reflect a premature cold air of winter. Now again, the Roi Baka would prove just the opposite, and that's why the Gemara says Eini. Eini means this is true. The Roi Baka pointing out that we need, so to speak, an extra month of Adar, so that the month of Adar, after you extend Shvat for a month of Adar will reflect the normal conditions. And then we have no reason to make the Kohen Gadol into a Nogei Avodah, right? The Kohen Gadol doesn't lose anything by being Ma'abra the Shana. But the Gemara says that's not the reason for Ibur Shana. Although in certain cases it could be very true that it might turn out that through Ibur Shana you'll get the normal weather conditions that should be appropriate for that month, let's say Adar or Tishrei in our case. But that was just a mazel, that was just a coincidence. The Rabbanan have different calculations and reasons why they would be Ma'abra the Shana. And those calculations would not necessarily have anything to do with Kar and Chom, with the coldness of winter and the warmth of the sun. So B'li Neder will have an Ian Shir today at 10:30, but tomorrow's sugya will go through the Roi Baka again, and once again we'll have an overview of what Ibur Shana is all about, and then we start the sugya of Ishus, which I'm hoping will give us a little bit of insight into the question that we had before about whether there's a possibility of chalitza without yibum. Because as we saw in the case of the Kohen Gadol, if his brother dies, then he will give chalitza to his sister-in-law. He can't give her yibum because she's an alman. Okay then? Okay. That's it. Thank you.